It's the New Year's Eve edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, a rant about the Supreme Court and prostitution, and from the vault, some of the best of this year's Radio Free Thinker. Eulogy for Aaron Swartz, 1984, a skeptical look at the surveillance state, and does hockey need violence? Let's begin episode 238.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross-sort politics, religion, economics, and, of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of smart stuff. We are aware of the cosmos to know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others. We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome to Radio Freethinker, Vancouver's number one local skeptical radio show. It is me, Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. Well, it seems the Supreme Court of Canada has lifted the shadow that forced practitioners of a particular profession to find the most hidden, secluded, police-free environment to do their work. I work in computers. Imagine if I had to take a valuable laptop out to the park late at night, make sure that no one could see me, especially the police, so I could service a client's PC needs. That's not the end of it. I am forced to use cash because if authorities find out my source of income, I could be arrested. So besides the valuable PC, I'm also forced to carry around large amounts of money. What happens if I get robbed of that money? A client refuses to pay for the PC, and they just take it anyway. What if there's violence? Again, I can't go to police because what I'm doing is deemed illegal. And why is it illegal? Well, the official reason is that the business is risky and poses a potential health threat and danger to the workers, which of course only largely exists because it's deemed illegal. If I could sell PCs in the open, I could, like any other merchant, rely on the justice system to protect me. Of course, the real reason we ban this profession is because it's deemed immoral, goes against God's law. Now some of you may be a little confused, so let me start again, hoping lights and heads will go on. Well, it seems the Supreme Court of Canada has lifted the shadow that has forced sex workers to find the most hidden, secluded, police-free environments to do their work. In particular, they struck down three laws. One, the communication for the purposes of prostitution in a public place. Essentially, this means that a prostitute now has the ability to sort of vet and interview a client before they go someplace unsafe to perhaps do their work. Two, living off the avails of prostitution. Essentially, the money that a prostitute makes by selling work can now be used to pay for employees, let's say a bouncer. Let's say to keep a safe home or business where they could perform their work in safety and security. And three, the keeping of a common bawdy house. Now, a bawdy house is deemed to be any place where sex is being performed or someone is being exploited. So this will limit now what a bawdy house is to the sex with minors, and again, the exploitation of people, where the term exploitation is sort of ill-defined, but in this context, we should think sex exploitation. And in a eureka moment, the vote was unanimous. Strike a light for reason. It's, I think, important to note that prostitution or sex work in and of itself is not technically legal, and that these laws were always intended to make the practice of said profession impossible under the law. Now, those who may think that this is a bad thing, let's go over the arguments that would hold that prostitution or sex work should be illegal. I'm going to start with the easy one. Prostitution puts women, rarely is it mentioned that male prostitution is a thriving industry, that it puts women in harm's way, i.e. physical assault. The answer to this is yes and no. Yes, because this is true only because they cannot go to the police. If they do, they risk being arrested for prostitution. It's true because they are forced to work in high-risk areas because, again, the risk of being arrested for prostitution. No, because if they could set up a regular service, think something like a hairdresser, they could operate in safe areas, knowing that they could, like any other citizen, call on the police for help if someone goes and endangers their safety. Think for a moment, someone walks into a 7-Eleven, beats up a clerk, steals their money from the till, and grabs a case of smokes on the way out. They would call the police, a warrant would be issued, steps would be taken to ensure the safety of the employees. You wouldn't sit there and say, listen, we should ban all convenience stores. Sex workers are denied, or were denied, this. They were on their own, and yes, abuses occurred because they were on their own. Prostitution forces women into slavery by johns who, either because they have an existing addiction or get them addicted to drugs, beat them up and take their money. So this particular argument, again, has a yes-no response. Yes, because if you can't call on the police for protection, you call on whoever else is available. So these are people who are willing to work in illegal professions, people who are themselves criminals. And you get your gangsters and other lowlifes who will protect their girls from the johns, But of course, you're still in the Shadowlands. And who will protect the workers from their pimp? Who can they call if the pimp beats them up? Steals their money? No, because again, if you made this a regular business, the sex workers could use law-abiding protection, rent-a-cops, for example, and set up regular storefronts. And with regards to drug addiction, studies have shown that most sex workers did not become addicted because of sex work, but from other factors. Think abuse of parents, poverty, and that they turned to prostitution to feed their habit. It is one industry where anyone can make a lot of money with little effort or experience. The studies I have read have it anywhere from 60 to 80% of addiction rates prior to becoming sex workers. Correlation is not causation. And before someone points out an oppositional study, I agree that prostitution, as currently established, i.e. illegal, leads to greater level of drug use to deal with the stress of the job. Let us not forget that one might want to take the edge off if one is working in an environment where you could be hurt, and if you call the police, you'd be arrested. People would be nuts not to seek some form of solace. On that regard, most people tend to think that prostitutes are somehow damaged, that it was addiction, child abuse, or some other factor that forced them into sex work. The truth is, it's easy money. It's good money. And in one study in Denmark, 85% said they did it for the money. And according to research, a number of people do it just because they enjoy the sex. Yes, sex workers may actually enjoy their job, unlike the rest of us respectable industries. Okay, I'm sure after the 1500 job, sex workers might be like the rest of us, but still. In Germany, where prostitution is completely legal, the one issue that has arisen is the, quote, vulnerable immigrants are brought in and abused by pimps. In response to this, I point out that our foreign worker program in Canada has created a situation, I'm sure not uniquely, where Tim Hortons in Fernie, BC has allegedly abused and ripped off its workers. Should we make donuts illegal? Abusive and exploitive employers are not a feature of the sex trade, but of capitalism. Another straw man, or maybe I should say straw woman, or perhaps straw girl, is that if we allow prostitution to be open and legal, then the floodgates will open up for shipping millions of preteen girls from the third world to satisfy the pricks in Canada. Why is it any more moral, right, if they are shipped over here to work in sweatshops? The issue is not the kind of work they're doing, but the exploitation, be it of their age or of being forced to work. Anyone who raises this as an issue is either ignorant, stupid, or just lying about their intent. I'm not saying exploitation for sex work is okay. I'm not saying minors doing sex work is okay. But that exploitation for work of any kind is wrong. Eyes on the prize, folks. A biggie, of course, is that women are objectifying their bodies, that prostitution dehumanizes women and makes them an object to be used. Selling your body for money is modern slavery. This argument has some merit. But I don't see how it's a sex trade issue, but a capitalism issue. I sell my body every day to an employer who gives me money in exchange for performing certain acts. Okay, my job is not physical, as in prostitution, but what if I were a fashion model or a masseuse? That's pretty similar. What about gay men who are prostitutes? And yes, a number of men are straight gigolos, but for the sake of this argument, let's limit ourselves to the gays. How does the turning women into sexual objects and not people, leading all women to be objectified, denigrated, how does that work? Male Johns turn male sex workers into objects of maleness? In philosophical terms, this is kind of incoherent. The John is then objectifying and denigrating himself. Just to exemplify the mental contortions one must go through to separate sex work from any other kind of work, in Germany, where there are those concerns about exploitations of foreign workers, there is a move on to amend the laws to, and I quote CBC here, in fact, the newly elected German government is looking to revise the laws to make it illegal to buy sex from women who've been forced into prostitution. Really? There needs to be a separate law? How legal would it be if I were forced to work at Walmart? Or is there currently a law for a business that operates that forces its employees to work at a job or under conditions that they don't want to work? I blame the Pope, Jesus, the entire feckin' religious morality. I sell my body 8 hours a day and I hear no uproar. It's not prostitution that is a crime. Prostitution is the oldest profession. The crime is capitalism, and that is what turns humans into commodity. We're going to be back with a couple of classic clips from Radio Freethinker after this break.
Despite the fact that 8 in 10 Canadians are against warrantless and costly online spying, the government remains stubborn, set to cement this scheme into law. With their huge PR budget, they've unleashed a reckless and irresponsible campaign that suggests warrantless collection of our private data is on par with a phone book. We can't let them trick Canadians. Go to www.openmedia.ca now to find out what you can do to get involved and stop this smoke and mirrors campaign the government has started.
And we're back on Radio Freethinker.
So this past week, we lost one of the truly important people to skepticism, Aaron Swartz. Now, many of our skeptic audience may or may not know the name. Many may not think of him as skeptic warrior. However, I believe he was.
Aaron started his public life in helping to define the RSS standard. This is the newsfeed protocol that gives you your rolling list of what's happening on Facebook, the CBC News app, and of course, how you get the latest edition of Radio Free Thinker on iTunes. Aaron was involved in another project that turned out to be one of those internet gold mines, Reddit. Now, he kind of fell into this good fortune. He spent most of his effort to make information accessible to all, to free knowledge. He laid down the foundations for the Open Library Project. He was a major force behind the Creative Commons Project. But where he moved beyond the average progressive was his activism for freedom of the internet, freedom of knowledge. He started Demand Progress. Never heard of that? Remember last year when the internet went black? Wikipedia, WordPress, Craigslist, Tumblr, Twitter, and a lot of other sites shut down for the day? Well, that was Aaron at work, not as a terrorist, but as an organizer of the online community against legislation that threatened to shut down the internet as we know it. One of the most onerous provisions was a website could be shut down without notice or appeal if there was a link on that site, be it in the contents or the comments section, that linked to a site that was deemed to have quote-unquote illegal content. This would have made the ability for sites to act as a public forum impossible. He put his status, his money, and his efforts to start Demand Progress, which acted as a bulwark to this threat. He brought on board the other great internet giants, and more importantly, all the common people, and the bill died. Progress won. He had a strong sense that public information should be public. To this end, he first ran afoul of the law when in 2009, public access to court electronic records, or PACER, claimed documents were stolen. PACER is an electronic public access service in the United States for federal court documents. It allows users to obtain case and docket information for the United States district courts, appeal information, bankruptcy court things. PACER was charging 8 cents a page to access this quote-unquote public information. This struck many, including Aaron, as being wrong, and worse, a hindrance to a well-functioning democracy. Aaron took his money and his skills, and he did something. He used his money, over $1.5 million, and he purchased millions of documents from PACER, and then hosted them on another site called Recap, which actually allowed the public to access these documents for free. This, of course, annoyed the government greatly, and the FBI investigated, but they couldn't find where any laws were broken. After all, this was public information available to the public. However, Aaron had now set himself up as an enemy of the state. In late 2010, Aaron was feeling slightly frustrated as a non-student, quote, guest of MIT. He was a figurehead around the campus, but he was not technically a student, that he was not given access to JSTOR unless he paid for it. Now, many may or may not know that JSTOR is a preeminent warehouse of academic articles, journals, and published papers. It's a nonprofit, but they've created a paywall to limit access, largely to academic institutions like UBC et al. This struck Aaron as wrong because the vast majority of the works published were funded by tax dollars. It should be available to everyone. And as skeptics, we know the importance of information and the availability, but in order to make sound decisions. In his effort to free knowledge, he slipped a laptop into an unlocked network closet, something that was not uncommon on the campus, and using a script, downloaded articles from JSTOR. Now, this particular connection he had did have legal access to the JSTOR library. He was not hacking into their computers in any sense that we'd think about it. This apparently, again, is something that's not uncommon. The only difference is that this time, Aaron downloaded 4 million articles or so. Now, it seems that Aaron did have, like I say, legal access to computers that had JSTOR, but the bulk of the original complaint was that he was downloading too many articles. To quote one report, "As best as we can tell, he was being charged for allegedly downloading too many scholarly articles from the website. It is like checking out too many books from the library." When JSTOR admins and MIT realized the massive downloads, they blocked the PC Aaron was using to access the site. Aaron, being an internet genius, started a cat and mouse game where he would alter his PC online performance and resume downloading. Ultimately, the physical PC was discovered and removed. It's important to note that this was not a hacker operation, or Aaron had no ill intent. The PC he used had no encryption software. There was no attempts to cover his tracks. Although annoyed at Aaron's tactics, no harm was really done. So JSTOR declined to press charges. Even MIT was reluctant to prosecute Aaron when Aaron agreed to return the articles and not publish any of them online, as was his apparent original idea. However, part of his original idea, too, I should note out, he was not intending to make any money off this. He was going to, again, just publish articles so people would have access to the knowledge. However, Now is when things really get ugly, and where we as progressive skeptics may take a note. Aaron had allegedly angered the government with the Pacer incident. Thwarted federal legislation for SOPA and PIPA. Those are the things that are attempted to shut down the internet I mentioned earlier. And keeping the internet free, there's a free movement. So given the opportunity, the prosecutor literally threw the book at him, or so to speak. He was charged with wire fraud, computer fraud, unlawful attainment of information, and recklessly damaging protected computer. Most of which is not really true, but it depends on how you interpret the strictness of the law. He was to be fined millions of dollars, and prosecutors were pushing for at least 35 years in jail. I want you to take note, 35 years in jail is more than you get for like manslaughter, more than you get for bank robbery, so they were really pushing the limits on this. Attempts to plea bargain were stonewalled, and it looked like at best Aaron was heading for, like I say, a multi-million dollar legal battle with the federal government. Rumors, and yes, they are only rumors, purport to point out that the federal government was also at this point trying to get someone in the hacker community to testify against Bradley Manning. And Bradley Manning, of course, is quite famous for the WikiLeaks documents about American activities in Afghanistan. It seems, of course, Aaron had other issues, and don't we all? We've talked previously about the subject of bullying leading to suicide. I can't see little difference here. What can you do when the state becomes the bully? To our audience, when an opportunity for you to bring to light something you think is of national interest, the public good, but might run you afoul of our political leaders, are you going to think twice? Do you want to go through what someone like Aaron went through? That's how they win. Aaron is dead, and with him, a dynamic force for internet freedom and access to knowledge. We currently have our own progressive movement, the Idle No More. Although focused on a very different topic, it shares one aspect. At what point do you say that the government of state is not the government of the people? There is no happy ending. There's no inspirational speech. No light at the end of the tunnel. It's not like fiction. It's neither neat nor tidy. It's what it is. But now I have to ask, what are you going to do about it? We're going to end with a outtake of Aaron himself.
It has this big, long list of names supporting the bill, and then just a few lonely people opposing it. And then on the other side, it says January 15th. And now it's totally reversed. Everyone is opposing it. Just a few lonely names still hanging on in support. I mean, this really was unprecedented. Don't take my word for it, but ask former Senator Chris Dodd, now the chief lobbyist for Hollywood. He admitted, after he lost, that he had masterminded the whole evil plan. And he told the New York Times he'd never seen anything like it during his many years in Congress. And everyone I've spoken to agrees. The people rose up and they caused a sea change in Washington. Not the press, which refused to cover the story. Just coincidentally, their parent companies all happened to be lobbying for the bill. Not the politicians, who were pretty much unanimously in favor of it. And not the companies who had all but given up trying to stop it and decided it was inevitable. It was really stopped by the people themselves. They killed the bill dead. So dead that when members of Congress propose something now that even touches the internet, they have to give a long speech beforehand about how it is definitely not like SOPA. So dead that when you ask congressional staffers about it, they groan and shake their heads like it's all a bad dream they're trying really hard to forget. So dead that it's kind of hard to believe this story. Hard to remember how close it all came to actually passing. Hard to remember how this could have gone any other way. But it wasn't a dream or a nightmare. It was all very real. And it will happen again. Sure, it will have yet another name, and maybe a different excuse, and probably do its damage in a different way. But make no mistake, the enemies of the freedom to connect have not disappeared. The fire in those politicians' eyes hasn't been put out. There are a lot of people, a lot of powerful people, who want to clamp down on the internet. And to be honest, there aren't a whole lot who have a vested interest in protecting it from all of that. Even some of the biggest companies, some of the biggest internet companies, to put it frankly, would benefit from a world in which their little competitors could get censored. We can't let that happen. Now, I've told this as a personal story, partly because I think big stories like this one are just more interesting at human scale. The director, J.D. Walsh, says good stories should be like the poster for Transformers. There's a huge evil robot on the left side of the poster, and a huge big army on the right side of the poster. And then in the middle, at the bottom, there's just a small family trapped in the middle. Big stories need human stakes. But mostly it's a personal story, because I didn't have time to research any other part of it. But that's kind of the point. We won this fight because everyone made themselves the hero of their own story. Everyone took it as their job to save this crucial freedom. They threw themselves into it. They did whatever they could think of to do. They didn't stop to ask anyone for permission. You remember how Hacker News readers spontaneously organized this boycott of GoDaddy over their support of SOPA? Nobody told them they could do that. A few people even thought it was a bad idea. It didn't matter. The senators were right. The internet really is out of control. But if we forget that, if we let Hollywood rewrite the story so it was just big company Google who stopped the bill, if we let them persuade us we didn't actually make a difference, if we start seeing it as someone else's responsibility to do this work, and it's our job just to go home and pop some popcorn and curl up on the couch to watch Transformers, well then next time, they might just win. Let's not let that happen.
Standing on a planet. Really, I'm just a speck. I'm just a speck compared with a star.
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Approximately 200 days ago, a young new employee of Booz Allen, a contractor for the American National Security Agency, mysteriously disappeared from his home in Hawaii. He reappeared in Hong Kong several days later when the world learned the name Edward Snowden. And ever since, this whistleblower has been shedding light on the depth and length of the surveillance state, not only in the US, but other nations as well, including Canada. One of the unintended consequences of this event was shortly after Snowden's first interview with the Guardian reporter Glenn Greenwald, the sales of George Orwell's dystopic novel 1984 rose by over 4,000%. For those who may not have read the novel or seen any of its adaptations, the basic premise of the novel can be summed up as a totalitarian surveillance state. The leader of the state was Big Brother, a term we now see as synonymous with government spying. Here's what the author had to say about the future.
But he left one final warning.
1984 is, I believe, a quite terrifying masterpiece. So terrifying, in fact, I don't think I should like to read another like it.
Something like 1984 could actually happen. This is the direction the world is going in at the present time. There will be no loyalty except loyalty to the party. But always there will be the intoxication of power. Always, at every moment, there will be the thrill of victory, the sensation of trampling on an enemy who is helpless. If you want a picture of the future, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
Now, there are a number of things that are similar to 1984 and other things that are not. I thought I would take a quick look at just how much 1984 is in the now, and more specifically, do we live in a 1984-esque surveillance state? As a good skeptic, the first thing we should ask, what makes a surveillance state? First, can the government keep a constant eye on us? In the novel 1984, every person had a state-controlled TV in the room, which had the ability to surveil the entire room. The idea is there was not a corner you could go to have a private conversation. If you were doing something nonconformist, you were told so via the TV. The role of the TV in the novel, and emphasized throughout the novel, is the idea of personal space. Having a private moment or conversation was impossible. Big Brother was always watching you, so you'd better conform or else. Obviously, George Orwell got this wrong. Or did he? How many of our listeners right now have a cell phone on them? This single device is a fountain of metadata that is constantly tracking where you are, what you're doing, as well as who you're contacting. One of the things that has come to light is not only that the government collects your metadata, but it can do so without any real oversight. Supreme Court decisions in the U.S. have stated that metadata is not protected by your right of privacy. Our own Supreme Court has yet to rule on this issue, but it is telling that it was not until the revelations of Snowden that a case brought by the BC Civil Liberties Association and Open Media has even been attempted. In fact, with very few exceptions, anything that is not explicitly a phone conversation or written correspondence is deemed to be public and thus not protected. Remember when you signed up for your Skype account or Gmail or whatever? In the legalese, you signed over your privacy rights to the host company. When you did this, you also waived your rights to privacy vis-a-vis the surveillance state. Now you might say, what the heck is metadata? Metadata, with regards to your phone, is everything but the conversation. Your cell phone contains a plethora of sensors, everything from GPS, accelerometers, temperature sensors, compasses, and much, much more. In many ways, this information can be more revealing than the actual spoken part. You might ask, well, how is this non-talking part of my call more revealing than the talking part? Let's envision a classic call. Hello, honey. Sorry, I'm going to be a little late. Eat supper. I should be home by 10. Gotta work. That's the call. From that, you would guess that he is at work being productive. However, if you look at the metadata, we find the call was made while he was driving into a red light district, that he used his phone to pay for parking at a particular address, that after their call to their honey, they made another call. You cross-reference that number to a directory database, and you find the number for Lonely Lovers Inc. You can see by their GPS that the phone stopped at the address of said Lonely Losers. It also showed that the person stayed there for about 90 minutes and that their phone directed all send calls to the voicemail. Well, I could go on, but you get the message. You could find out a lot from metadata, perhaps much more than listening in. In this thought experiment, the conversation painted a very different and inaccurate picture of the scene than the metadata did. The metadata never lies. It has also come to be known that not only are they collecting this metadata, but every time you send an email, it is being scanned for content. This is done by your service provider, such as Google. Read terms and conditions. And as we will learn later, the government as well. One hypothetical to make the point about metadata. Imagine how you would feel if you woke up one morning and saw someone going through your garbage. What if they did that every day? What if they didn't actually take anything, but they made notes about what you threw out, where you shopped, your bills, who sent you mail? Likely you'd be outraged. You'd call the cops. How would you feel that if every time you looked around the corner, there was someone taking a note about where you were, who you talked to, what you bought, what time you got to work, when you left? This is what we're talking about with regards to metadata. It is the fact that metadata, well, data in general, is virtual. You can't see it, touch it, or smell it. This virtualness allows us to overlook the fact that it is real and can affect our lives. As more and more of our lives are lived online, the less privacy we really have. So whereas the 1984 state had to create an elaborate network of TVs in every room, we have voluntarily bought our own personal surveillance device and dutifully carry it with us 24/7. So the state has the capability to keep a constant eye on us. In fact, to a far greater degree than Orwell could have possibly imagined. The latest to surface is that the NSA has hacked into computers at the major companies such as Google, Microsoft, Yahoo, and others, and quote, hoovered up data traffic between these companies' data centers. This is where we store all our information in the cloud. It's our online chats, our email. It's pretty much everything we have online. This activity is supposed to be governed by special courts or crown ministers. However, these restrictions only apply to internal spying. These agencies are given pretty much carte blanche when spying on other nations. Now, you may have noticed I switched from the singular to the plural. Canada is part of a group known as the Five Eyes, a group set up during World War II where each country's spying agency would be pooled and share intelligence. This group includes the US, UK, Australia, and New Zealand. This means that while our own CSEC, that's Communication Security Establishment Canada, while CSEC has restrictions for spying on Canadians, there are none for its spying on Americans. Conversely, the NSA has no restrictions for spying on foreigners, such as you and me. Couple this with the fact that much of the telecommunication traffic travels through the US at some point, regardless of sender-receiver, that they have the ability essentially to track it all. What do I mean by all of it? The NSA is about to open a new data center with a storage capacity of 1 yottabyte. A yottabyte is 1 trillion terabytes. Currently, the annual internet traffic, i.e. all the data on the internet, is approaching 1 zettabyte. This NSA center could store 1,000 years worth of this internet. All the data. Now, I'd like to tell you what the capacity of the CSEC was, but our nation's passion for top secret outstrips the US, and that was information I could not find or didn't seem to be available. So it seems that not only has the state the ability, but the willingness to track everyone. And what do I mean by that? In the news recently, we learned that Canada has been spying on the president of Brazil. It was revealed that the US has tapped German Chancellor Merkel's phone for over a decade. The classic example for the reasoning for the surveillance state is to stop terrorism. But it seems hard to understand why they would need to tap our allies' communication. This is not unique to the US or Canada. The G20 meeting in London in 2009 had special internet cafes set up to facilitate the monitoring of the communications of the attending parties. The recent G20 in Russia similarly had revelations about attempted spying. Okay, now most of us, we likely know, at least to some degree, surveillance was going on. Let us not forget the growing networks of CCDs on street corners. During the Olympics here in Vancouver, we all knew we were being watched. But many of us should be shocked at the total magnitude of the spying going on. Now, some people say, well, I have nothing to hide, and that may be true. But the government is storing your data for years, decades, centuries. Well, what if your name is similar to a real suspect, or there's a typo, or someone just gets it wrong? They can then go back through this data, and then you have what us skeptics like to call anomaly hunting. Did you know that when you bought that latte at Starbucks, the head of the Gambino family was also enjoying a coffee there? And how do you explain that you bought a propane tank just 2 days before one was used to kill a Gambino rival? And so it goes. In the world of boundless informant and total information awareness, innocence and nothing to hide may only be lame excuses for someone committing pre-crime. Okay, but the surveillance was only part of the state control. Another vital aspect was the ability to control the past. As put in the movie 1984, he who controls the present controls the past. He who controls the past controls the future. This played out in 1984, where hordes of bureaucrats would pore over newspapers to make corrections. That is, change things like, let's say someone in the government predicted that a crop production for a particular year would be 12 billion tons. Then it turned out the year yield was only 10 billion. It would be the job of these people to find all the articles that printed the 12 billion number, white it out, and replace it with 10 billion. Thus, every statement the party said was correct. Now again, hampered by reality and the inability to see the rise of the digital age, the mechanism Orwell thought of would not likely have done what he intended it to do, i.e. whitewash history. But is it possible now? If you think about it, as more and more of our correspondence is online, we get our news from the internet, our research for topics like this is largely done via digital libraries of the world. There are magnitudes more information published online than in the real world. There are constant efforts to digitize printed material, so it will not be lost to time, as all real objects will eventually disappear. Now, couple this with the fact that more and more of our online data is being housed in fewer and fewer entities. We no longer store our documents on our PC, but upload them to Google Docs or some other cloud service. It is estimated that Google alone has at least 10 exabytes of data stored in its data farm. How much is 10 exabytes? Well, all the data created by humanity from the dawn of awareness to 2003 equals about 5 exabytes. So what happens if someone decides to edit history? In Orwell's time, you would need to recall every offending newspaper to edit them and then redistribute them. Now all you need is a digital worm or virus that will weave its way through the data centers of the world, altering their files. In one simple step, you now control the digital past. So far we have seen, not only do we have the surveillance state, but in many ways it's far worse than Orwell protected. So does this mean we live in a totalitarian surveillance state? Well, I only have a few minutes to retrieve society from Big Brother's boot, so here goes. The short answer, do we live in a totalitarian state? No. Although it is much more possible for this dystopia of 1984 to become real, there are significant numbers of missing factors. We do not have a one-party state. Now, it is possible that the corporocracy that we now experience will become a ruling class and emulate the party, but as yet, it only has significant influence and not total control. We still live in a democracy. We still have the possibility to take control of our lives. In 1984, there was no civil dissent. Although through events like Toronto's G20, one could make the argument that civil dissent has been greatly reduced. But there is still space, for now, for political dissension, for debate. Implicit in the novel is journalism being complicit with the state. And although mainstream media has followed this line, there is still a significant alternative press to ensure that we do not succumb to newspeak. Although much of our media is intended to distract us from real issues of state, there are venues for people to not only become aware, but on rare occasions, do something. Now, although torture does seem to be an acceptable practice now, it is still limited in its application, so we do not have to worry about thought crime yet. If there is one thing you should take away from this talk, it is not to be afraid, but to be pissed off. We are well on our way to a world envisioned in 1984. I have covered only one aspect, the surveillance state. But if we walk complacently into the future, allow our government to do things that are antithetical to a democratic society, well, who knows? Allowing the creation of the precondition for a totalitarian state, we may then be condemned to live in 1984 forever. A last word from the author.
The moral to be drawn from this dangerous nightmare situation is a simple one. Don't let it happen. It depends on you.
Radio Free Thinker will return after this break.
Today in the news.
And today in the news.
Today in the news.
Tired of the same few voices giving you the same point of view on the news? You're not alone. The Campaign for Democratic Media is a nonpartisan, nonprofit group fighting to ensure that our public airwaves represent more than just one voice. Canadians deserve diverse, accountable, and quality Canadian media. Visit democraticmedia.ca to learn how you can stand up for media issues.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So today we're going to add another topic to our sports skepticism series with a discussion of violence in hockey. Specifically, we will answer the age-old question of can you take the violence out of hockey and have it still be interesting?
And to do it justice, me and Ethan are going to have a fight about it.
Sure, why not?
Okay, come on.
Drop the gloves. Let's talk about hockey violence. And I think we should decide on what we're talking about to avoid confusion. So let's list some of the violence that is common in the game. I've broken it down into a couple of categories here. So the first one is what we would consider accidental violence. So we might have, you know, two players colliding or getting hit with a puck or something like that. And this is basically, we can't really remove this because when you have a sport with people traveling this fast, wearing this kind of equipment on ice, you're going to have incidents like this pop up. So that's sort of accidental violence.
So Ian, how do you determine accidental from not quite accidental?
Well, we'll get into that in a bit. Okay. Then we have on purpose minor violence. So typically this comes in the form of tripping, slashing, hooking, those sort of things. This type of violence is curtailed in the game with penalties. Most players would admit that it's no fun to be slashed, but they also wouldn't hold a grudge against the person who slashed them in the first place.
Better man than me, Gungadin.
Well, it's basically part of the game, and you can accidentally, on purpose, slash somebody to prevent a breakaway. You may get 2 minutes in the box, but you may have saved a goal. It's just a natural part of the game, and you know, as long as those sticks don't come up into the face, you're pretty good. But that leads into the next major area, on-purpose major violence. So we got hits to the head, hits from behind, kicking, stomping, any type of violent behavior with your stick towards the person's head, or something that goes beyond, above and beyond the standard sort of two-minute penalty. Typically in a game, this type of violence would earn a player either 4 to 5 to 10 minutes of penalty time, a game misconduct, which means getting tossed out of the game, or a suspension, getting banned for X number of games.
So don't get me wrong, because I'm not as big in hockey as Ethan is here. Stomping, you mean with this long knife thing they have on the bottom of their feet, they use it as a deadly weapon to attempt to kill someone else on the... Sorry. They don't attempt to kill somebody. They just attempt to hurt them.
Well, it typically... Stomping has only occurred in about 4 instances that I can recall in NHL history. Each time, it has either been handed a 20-plus game suspension or a lifetime suspension. It's pretty serious, and kicking is another thing that I'll get into in a bit because it's specifically forbidden by the, quote, code. And players who do stuff like that typically not only will face things like suspensions and discipline, but usually will be ostracized by their own teammates. They won't talk to them. They'll be eventually be forced to be traded simply because it's like you've broken the code, so you're no longer one of us. So moving on from sort of on-purpose major violence, we have the special category of hockey fights. So you might say, why is this a special category? Well, I think hockey fights are unique in the sports world. I don't think many sports even allow fighting, let alone the way the NHL does. Hockey fights are typically between two willing combatants, usually, quote, the enforcers on each team. And usually what happens is the fight is either determined by the two enforcers are on the ice at the same time and they say, okay, let's go. Or one guy wants to rev up his teammate, so he starts a fight. The referees will sort of cordon them off, let them go for, you know, 40 seconds, and then they'll both sort of get tired and stop. In instances where you don't have two enforcers fighting, where you, say, have a big guy picking on a little guy, this is usually going to cause a bench-clearing brawl or receive major penalties like instigating, which is a controversial penalty in hockey. So typically, you don't have kind of the big guy picking on the little guys. It's mostly the enforcers on each other. And that's a really interesting point.
Sorry, but I have one question here. And you, I think you're going to cover it a little bit later, but from what you just said.
Mm-hmm.
So an enforcer, what does an enforcer do? Like, why is he called the enforcer?
Well, the enforcer is basically the sort of, they're also called goons. They're sort of like the mob protection racket of hockey. And we'll get into this in a moment. Actually, what I'm going to do is I'm going to play a quote from Don Cherry, who, if you don't know who Don Cherry is, he's this sort of conservative hockey pundit who promotes things like
fashion.
Well, yeah, but I'll play the clip and have a listen, and then I'll chat about this after.
You know, it's so sad when you see this. Now we got politicians in on it. They're going to ban fighting out of junior. They're going to do this. Now, folks, listen to me. I played for the Windsor Spitfires. I played for the Barry, and we won the Memorial Cup, and I coached junior. You cannot ban fighting out of junior hockey. And I'll tell you why. And David Branch and everybody should look. I was in it. I played it. I coached it. You have 20-year-olders in the league, and you have 16-year-olders in the league. The 16-year-olders are dynamite, or they wouldn't be there. Now, usually the older guys will leave the younger guys alone until you get, if you're going to make the playoffs or something like that. If it means the playoffs, some of these big guys go after. They got nothing to lose, the overage or something. They go after these young guys. If you don't have somebody to step in and take a charge and keep those guys off it, those 16-year-olders will be open season. Now, you don't know as much as me about junior hockey. I played it and coached it.
So that is Don Cherry with his sort of trademark folksy advice. He's talking about a pretty famous incident that occurred in junior hockey, but I think it also easily applies to the NHL. Now, he mentions how 16-year-olds need to be protected, which is very similar to how, quote, skill players need protection. Now, an example in the NHL that we're familiar with would be Wayne Gretzky. When he was playing for the Oilers, there were several enforcers who made sure that anyone who took any cheap shots on Gretzky would answer to them. And basically, this is sort of the enforcer code. The enforcers exist to protect your skilled players, to make sure people aren't taking liberties with your teammates. It's kind of this, like, you know, you mess with him, you're going to answer to me type thing.
But doesn't that just leave open for, like, Gretzky can now beat the crap out of anyone on the other teams because he's got the big bullies on the rink? Or, again, you know, I mean, if the enforcers are going after the other team's players, enforcer against enforcer, okay, maybe you can make a case for that. But it doesn't strike me the enforcer would be making the cheap shot because he's worried more about protecting his own.
Hmm.
It's the number two guy, not the great one, not the enforcer, but the middle guys who are the ones who are going to make the cheap shots. And then it strikes me, as you just said, it seems unfair.
Well, it gets sort of the complicated code of ethics with hockey players. So in an instance where, say, not an enforcer but someone else on the team takes a cheap shot on Gretzky, there's one or two things might happen. One, that player may just get a devastating body check from an enforcer with a little, you see what you got type thing. Or, you know, there may be sort of consequences about, like, well, you take a cheap shot on our star player, we're going to take a cheap shot on your star player. So there's all kinds of weird sort of comeuppance and ways this works, which factors into what is called the, quote, code in hockey, which is a honor system that it's an unwritten honor system, which is known by players, coaches, and officials. And you start learning about this while you're playing hockey as kids. So you start learning about the honor system from your coaches and your parents and your other players. And so by the time you're 20 or 21 and you're getting into the NHL, you've had this sort of drummed into your ethos, you know, since you were like 5 years old.
I thought Pee Wee hockey, like, there's no checking at all. And then the level above that, there's checking, but there's no, I mean, like, the really harsh. Yeah,
it's a scale up. A lot of it starts out as sort of general good sportsmanship. Like, you shake your opponent's hand, and you don't hit somebody when they're down, and you don't run up the score, and that kind of thing. And it kind of graduates as you get more physical in the game. So that's a bit about hockey violence. Now, let's take a look at the question, can we remove any of the violence from this game?
Yes.
Okay, yes. But first of all, do we even want to remove violence from the game? What do you think, Don?
Well, I think you have to answer the first question before the second question.
But you just did.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so again, as you point out, there are many, many other sports, skilled sports, mm-hmm. where violence is not only not a part of it, is almost anathema, right? I mean, and you're going to contradict me, I suspect, soon, but in general, soccer is a very non-violent sport. I mean, there is... violence gets seeped in there, but it is considered very much to be a faux pas to do it, and it's only done sort of under very specific circumstances.
That's right.
Baseball and basketball, another one. You know, like you occasionally will get a fight occurring, but it's like, oh, well, no, this is just horrible. Hockey seems to be sort of unique in that, but to be fair, North American hockey. If you take hockey into Europe, these things are dealt with much more harshly, much more. I mean, you sit there, and if you get into a fight, or if you even take your gloves off, you're kicked from the game. It's just like, no, yeah. We're not going to deal with that at all. So on that sense, why do you want violence in sports? Obviously, I don't, but you like hockey. You're into a hockey player. So, Ethan, I'm going to throw that right back at you. Would you watch a hockey game if you thought there was going to be no fight in it?
Well, I would probably be willing to watch a hockey game with no fighting. But I think it's important to, because you mentioned soccer, and we should discuss how other sports deal with violence.
I don't mean to laugh. This is a horrible, horrible story, but it is so extreme.
Yeah.
You can't take it seriously. But I mean, oh my God. Go on.
So this really amazing, horrifying thing happened very recently in the world of soccer. During a Brazilian soccer match, a referee stabbed a player to death.
Oh my God, that is such a horrible thing. Why would you? I mean, that is horrible. That's. I can never imagine it happening anything else. Don't tell me it gets worse.
So after he stabbed the player to death, the player's supporters rushed onto the field and drew and quartered him and beheaded him. Yeah.
Wow.
And I know this sounds like an urban legend, but there's video.
Yeah. No. That is. I mean. Well, so so what you're saying is that if we remove the violence from hockey, there's going to be drawn and quartering of people because that violence is just going to build up, and pretty soon we're going to have mass executions at Vancouver Stadium.
Well, the thing that I would take from this, and I mean, soccer is also a good example because it is on the surface a non-violent sport, but a lot of the sort of violence and aggression in soccer plays out in other kind of hideous ways. And we'll get into that in a moment. So one view is that if we sort of suck out all the violence in hockey, the surrounding violence in the culture of hockey would dissipate, which I think soccer proves wouldn't happen. In soccer, this is the sport where, you know, we not only have horrible instances of violence like this, we have riots, we have fans chanting racial slurs at people. We have...
Well, I have a question here because I agree with all that. But there's a very stark difference now you have. You have the players who are nonviolent, but you have fans which are very violent. Correct me if I'm wrong. That's the inverse of what you have pretty much with hockey. I mean, I know occasionally you'll get fights at a hockey game amongst, especially parents at junior leagues.
Mm-hmm.
But by and large, you don't get a riot when the Stanley Cup, bad example. But I mean, you know, rivalry between the New York Rangers and New York Islanders, I don't remember hearing riots erupt over them unless it's something like the Stanley, whereas you get much more common with soccer.
Yeah, like a famous example in hockey is the Richard riots. This was Maurice the Rocket Richard was a famous Montreal Canadian. He was suspended by a Toronto referee, sparked riots in the streets of Montreal. He had to go on the radio and plead with people to stop rioting. There's actually some instances in hockey that I'll mention that I think are kind of interesting to consider. But let's get back to sort of the removing of violence here. So I mentioned before accidental violence, and this is, you know, the things like injuries, misplays, random events. The only thing that I can think of to do with these is implement minor rule changes and increase equipment safety. And amazingly, this actually has lots of resistance. players do not like to wear visors.
Yeah, no, it's, well, the original face mask, right, yeah. was resisted, and it was 1960s when the first one was worn, and even then, I remember right up to the 80s, you had lots of people who would not wear any headgear at all because it blocked their view, and it was, and the fact that you have a puck, a solid lump of going at you at 100 miles an hour, it's like, eh, I can take it.
Yeah, I don't know, that's just really weird. On purpose, minor violence, again, it's kind of hard to imagine a game without penalties, hooking, slashing, etc. I think that on the whole, those sort of things can be addressed by, again, sort of minor rule changes. Now, this is where it gets complicated. The on-purpose major violence, hits to the heads, hitting from behind, all the stuff that we mentioned before. This sort of gets the most attention, but also some of the weirdest implementation of rules. We've seen new equipment. We've seen player education. The problem is that there's this sort of tradition in the NHL that the way this is to be handled is to rely on the code and let like enforcers deal with rule breakers and that kind of thing. But unfortunately, officials and referees don't seem to agree on this. So depending on who's playing and who's referee, you may get radically different responses to in-game violence. And the NHL has also demonstrated a severe lack of ability in the laying down consistent rules or even a consistent response to major violence. Typically, higher skilled players like maybe the Alex Ovechkins or the Sidney Crosbys will get smaller suspensions and lighter fines, whereas the less skilled players like the Matt Cooks and the Brad Mays of the world get longer suspensions and heavier fines.
So on that regards to letting the code deal with it, isn't that kind of like saying, well, we'll let the mob deal with the mob, right? We'll arrest people who are law-abiding citizens, but they have their own code and they will take care of themselves. Doesn't that seem to be wrong?
Yeah, I think it does. I think that this over-reliance on this ancient code of honor, unfortunately, on the one hand, is limiting the NHL's response, and it's also creating confusion and chaos for players trying to figure out what they can and cannot get away with.
That was one of the things I liked when I was looking at the rules for European hockey, is they're pretty, like, they're black and white. And there's like, if your gloves come off, you're out. Like, there's no like, did you want to start the fight or not? No, there's like some very, very strict tells that go with that. And I think that's a good thing for both. I mean, even if you don't make it as harsh, but the idea that there's black and white and that's how we determine it.
What's interesting, though, is that despite maybe our perception of hockey, it's actually become a lot less violent over the years. A classic example is the Broad Street Bullies, who were the 1972 Philadelphia Flyers. This version of the Flyers were basically a bunch of goons who would sort of beat up their opponents on a nightly basis and win the hockey game. It's shockingly, the idea that this could happen in today's NHL or any sport is so ridiculous. This was made to be like a Disney movie or something, a really sort of twisted Disney movie.
Well, if you look back at like 70s hockey, one of the proud trademarks of a hockey player was how few teeth he would have.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I mean, that was like a badge of honor.
Yeah. Another example would be the 1977 Boston Bruins. There was a famous incident where they got into a fight with the fans.
Their fans or the opponent's team?
I think it was the opponent's fans. And there's other examples, too. Back when the Quebec Nordiques were still around, the game with the Canadians would get really ugly. And there was an instance where the fans, because the cities were so close together, they would have like separate seating for the Quebec fans and the Montreal fans. They would get into fights all the time.
Oh, it's like soccer.
Yeah. And they would have like massive brawls. Nowadays, though, you don't usually see a bench-clearing brawl maybe like once a season, but if that. Back in the olden days, it was fairly often. I mean, even in baseball, you see a bench-clearing brawl usually a couple times a season. So it's actually kind of interesting in that sense.
Well, again, I think it's one of those problems we have with violence in general in our society is there's a lot more reporting, a lot more sort of news going around. So where before you had, you know, 10 events and you might hear about one of them, now you hear about one event 10 times and it seems like, wow, there must be so much of it going around, where again, there's a difference between perception and reality.
Yeah, which I think, so to get back to the original question here about removing violence, I think that a lot of the things that we've mentioned about where we can improve things, it's pretty obvious that we should. I think that player safety is pretty darn important. The big question, of course, is can you remove fighting? And since the European leagues have sort of managed to do that and put out a really sort of entertaining product, it's pretty obvious that you can remove fighting and keep the NHL fun. Now, unfortunately, there are a lot of stereotypes about European hockey players that they're not tough enough or manly enough, otherwise unfit to be in the NHL, which is starting to slowly change. But it is interesting to watch things like the Olympics or IFF, International Federation of Hockey, sanctioned matches where they have to play by international rules, where the referees call lots of penalties, lots of what we would consider a good hockey play would be considered a penalty. North American fans tend to hate that. And it tends to rile up a lot of people. So, I mean, would the North American fan even want to watch the NHL without fighting? And that, I think, is an interesting question.
Well, so I brought up Hitler once, so I might as well go down this path. I'm not going to bring up him again. But one of the things that I was thinking about this, especially the question you just posed just a minute ago, was the idea of domestic violence. I mean, you go back 50 years ago, right, and smacking around your woman was considered to be, well, you've got to keep control of the house. And if you didn't do that, men were seen, what, you don't do this? You let her talk back to you like that? Are you not a man? Mm-hmm. Right? And that was the real vibe I was getting from this idea that, well, you know, if you don't have any fights or any violence in hockey, you're somehow not manly enough in that. It strikes me as very outdated thinking.
Yeah. And what's one of the reasons why I think that a lot of, especially very early on when we started getting, like, Swedish players, Russian players in the NHL, there was always this kind of stigma about them. Like, you know, oh, don't pick the Russian player because you know that he's not going to show up. He's not going to give a full effort. And, you know, the Swedish guys are just going to skate to the bench if there's ever any, trouble on the ice. And we saw this repeated in Vancouver when the Canucks lost to the Boston Bruins. One of the big criticisms was that Vancouver, because we have so many Swedish players, they weren't tough enough. They couldn't fight the big bad Bruins. Of course, no one said that when Detroit, who was, you know, for so long a powerhouse in the league with some of the best Swedes in the world, won cup after cup after cup. No one said they weren't tough enough.
Yeah, well, you know, it's confirmation bias.
Well, exactly, right?
But I'm curious to know one thing. And again, you know, I apologize. I am a Canadian. I do like hockey to a certain degree, but I can't remember the last time I watched an actual hockey game. When it is televised and a fight breaks out, do they show the fight or do the cameras swerve off?
Well, they always show the fight.
So maybe that would be another interesting rule to employ is that, you know, NHL rules that if there is a fight on the thing, it's against the rules for the broadcasters to show it. I mean, it would be very hard to implement that.
Yeah.
It would be one of the things that would take out another. I mean, one of the reasons why you want to do it is this is an exciting thing and I'm going to, you know, charge up my audience that way. And if you sort of say, oh, God, no, let's not look at that. It's a horrible scene.
Well, I think that'd be very hard to do. I mean, because even sport leagues that don't allow fighting, if there's a fight that breaks out, they love it. If there's a fight in the NFL or Major League Baseball or basketball, it's like, you know, it'll be front page news, even more so than, I guess, hockey, because hockey's like, oh, yeah, of course there was a fight in a hockey game. Who cares? They're angry Canadians, you know? Like,
yeah, there's a slight difference. Well, no, maybe not. You kind of said that. I'm thinking like in auto racing.
Yeah.
You know, whenever there's a crash, you know, they all run there. And to a certain degree, you know, people kind of hope there's a crash. Ooh, look at all this sort of action all that. But it is still seen to be the exception. It is still a bad thing. You know, oh, my God, it's horrible that it's happened. Whereas you don't get that sort of, oh, it's horrible there's this fight in hockey. As you say, it's just, well, that's just a normal part of the day.
Yeah, it's really interesting, the perception of Canadian hockey players, particularly because, again, I recommend everyone check out Hockey at People's History. And HBO has been producing for 2 years now a series called 24/7, looking at... I believe the first one was looking at the Pittsburgh Penguins and the Washington Capitals, and then there was one on the New York Islanders or New York Rangers and Philadelphia Flyers. Even if you're not a hockey fan, you can really appreciate some of the insights as to why the players respect people who beat them up. Like it's really interesting how you'll have players go like, yeah, it was a huge fight. He broke my nose and I knocked out three of his teeth. He's a good guy. I like him. You know, like it's just, they think that about each other, right?
Well, yeah, no, I guess again, they all sort of on one level know what their job is and it's their job. It's
exactly.
There's nothing personal in this. You know,
this is your job. This is my job. Let's go. You know, that's their attitude. Well, I think we solved that problem.
Yes, we have. And let's, in 25 minutes.
Yeah. Well, this is Ethan, your freethinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
And this is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch. You must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits.